Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to Experience Focused Leaders. I'm delighted to bring to you Ravi Sani. Ravi is the CEO and founder of RKS Design that has been prolific for nearly four decades, bringing design to some of the most important products and companies in the world. He is currently also a founder and CEO of PA AI, which is productizing the design philosophy that he's invented called psychoesthetics. Ravi, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Alex. Happy to be here.
Ravi, let's start with something called psychoesthetics, TM. So this is your trademark. We'd love to understand what it is. I think everybody wants to create something beautiful, but very few of us have the experience and the depth and the breadth of your experience and knowing what that is. And then we all kind of hear that psychology is important, but there's a lot to unpack in terms of how to apply it. So tell us more.
So psychoesthetics is a term that I coined in 92 or 93, I forgot, because I'd been developing a methodology. It was human-centered. I had in the early part of my career, so I've been in design now for 50 years. In the early part of my career out of college, I got recruited into Xerox and into a think tank with the Human Factors Group, part of the industrial design team. And with 30 PhD psychologists, we were developing the first touchscreen interface.
So that's the stuff that Steve Jobs stole. You basically helped develop that Xerox PARC and these.
Yeah, it was all, it came out of PARC.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Jobs stole it or he did a trade or, but he definitely brought it to life.
There you go.
But the touchscreen was, it was something that needed to be developed at that time because the controls were so expansive. And it was a global product. You had different languages. You couldn't build a control panel large enough to do everything that you could do with digital printing at that time. So we could scan a document or a picture. We could put it into a document. We could write the copy and we could create a newsletter and send it all over the world. And so what I learned from the psychologists is that, it is all human factors. It's all psychology.
Yeah.
And then I wasn't really into corporate life. So I left after a couple years and started RKS Design. And at that time in 82, I said, I'm going to write an underpinning for the firm that's going to keep us human centered and grounded. And I wrote the underpinning. It's not how you feel about a design or an experience. It's how it makes you feel about yourself. So I turned the camera. I turned the camera 180 degrees. So if someone's looking at our design work, we're looking at them and we're watching what's happening. So understanding how people feel about themselves through things that come into their life is what it's all about.
For laymen like myself. So basically, the human-centered design is the opposite of product-centered design or me-centered, like I have something to sell you. We've built this thing. I came up with this innovation. Look at how great it is. It's much more, how do we make you, how do you, what do you feel in the first place? And then how do we create the types of feelings that you want to have more of through our product or service.
Yeah, and it's very grounded. You know, Maya Angelou had said, people forget what you said, people forget what you did, they'll never forget how you made them feel. And so over time, what we did is develop, or I did, was develop it into a structured methodology, and started applying that. So first big project we did, huge success, was Teddy Ruxpin, if you remember, in the 80s. It's phenomenal. Talking teddy bear captured the world. I used my methodology to make it relate to people. It's a Tuddly teddy bear. It comes to life. How does that make people feel? And that was a phenomenal success. And along the ways, we just started evolving, and we looked at Maslow's hierarchy, reinvented that into a mapping system that maps self-actualization, gives interactivity. We started building out in-depth personas.
So let's pause here. So like most people probably know the kind of fundamental, like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where you start with your basic survival needs and then move up to kind of connection and ultimately, you know, self-actualization. I think it goes beyond, even then the latest version goes like being in the service of something even bigger than ourselves. And so tell us, like, let's dive in. How does that apply in the world of design? I'm sure, you know, everybody wants to make their message connect to people, or their product or service to connect with people that way. How did you think about that?
Well, as we started using Maslow hierarchy, we found two things. One is that it was, you know, in some ways two-dimensional or one-dimensional, and that you had to like peg someone in on the ladder, but it didn't really help us create things that would motivate people to do things new for themselves they might otherwise not do. Just understanding, like, okay, this is basic, or this is high self-actualization. And so we looked at that and we said, well, let's start mapping this way. And we tested it. We mapped interactivity against self-actualization. And what we found is that that gave us four quadrants: a basic quadrant, a high interactivity quadrant, more of an aesthetic quadrant, and then a higher self-actualization quadrant. So we found is that we could map anything, and that everything falls into ratings as far as self-actualization against interactivity. Low interactivity, low self-actualization, the example is a paperclip.
Okay.
High interactivity. Now, yeah.
So let's pause that. Let's explain. So I can't do very much with a paperclip other than put it on. And it doesn't, like, using a paperclip doesn't make me feel like a, you know, richer, you know, more complete human being, right? Is that kind of the...
Exactly. It's almost mindless. You grab it, you use it, you don't think about it. And so it's low interactivity, it's low self-actualization.
Okay.
Right. So if we go far to the right, what's low self-actualization, high interactivity would be a tool like a skip loader. Eyes, ears, hands, feet, right? So you're engaging.
I don't know what is, sorry for, I like, I'm what is a skip loader?
A skip loader is a tractor with a shovel on it, basically.
Okay, got it. All right. Tells you so much. That tells you that I'm not of the menu of the doing anything with my hands straight. Okay, so it's a tractor, you interact with it extensively, but it's not making you fulfilled.
That's right. It's just a tool that you use at work.
It's a tool.
I've got a flashing, one of my overheads is flashing off and
you're,
on.
You're good. We can see you.
So, you know, highly interactive. You don't dream about it at night. It doesn't make you feel like you're a special person. It's a tool.
Maybe the first time, if you're a 14-year-old and you get on that, but then after that,
that's a different case.
Right? Yeah, exactly. All right, got it. So it's a tool. You're highly engaged in using it, but it doesn't define you who you are. Okay.
And then if we say, what is low interactivity and high self-actualization, we would say seeing the Mona Lisa is. You know, it's high experience. You got to get to Paris, You got to get a ticket. You wait in line to get into the Louvre. Walk past
Yeah, or
100.
this stupid accent, you drink, you smoke your cigarette, well, before you get into Louvre. Yeah,
Yeah.
so you do also, so you remember all this, is that, and then you come back and you tell like,
Well,
I've reached
when
my dream of
yeah,
seeing the
and when you
Mona.
see it, and when you see it, I mean, it feels like the longest, it's got to be the longest 15, 30 seconds, and there's people waiting in line and the guards there, and it's behind glass and it's behind a rope. But you remember it the rest of your life. You haven't touched it, you haven't interacted with it, you've just looked at it, and you remember it like yesterday.
Okay, got it. So maybe this is so because it was a special, rare experience. Paris has this place in our minds. Mona Lisa has this place in our minds. There's a scarcity, and so even though the glare from the protective screen sucks, and there's like crowds of smelly people, next to you, you remember. There's something to it. You
Yeah.
experience divine at that particular point
That's right.
in time, or sublime, maybe, is not, if not divine. So you experience, okay, got it. All right.
And then if we so say go far right, high
Yeah.
interactivity, high self-actualization. For some people, a sports car would be an example. So
Okay.
it's all the interactivity of the tractor, and it's the beauty and the self-actualization of the Mona Lisa. Every time they look at it, they feel accomplished, they feel empowered, they feel alive. It changes who they are. And they enjoy it, they love it, but there's something special about it to them. Coming from SoCal, which is a car culture, that's very relevant to how we see it. But we map, what's interesting is that as we
And so,
started.
SoCal. So let's just do it like for the sake of, city dwellers from New York and, in Paris who don't, maybe don't own cars. So like SoCal, it means that the sports car is, glamour of Hollywood, wind in your hair, you're enjoying, you are like, that's the California. What are the things that make it, like, is it just sort of the narrative, the cultural narrative that we have about a car as well,
Yeah,
like
but
that?
that's just an example.
Right.
That's just an example. It's, as you map, what we found is that we can map personas. So we do deep dive interviews. We've interviewed globally well over 3,000 people. And as you interview people and really, do the ethnography and learn about them, you find that you can map them as to where they are today. The voice of consumer on and on, but really understanding the people, you got to talk to people. And when you do that, you learn things and you can actually map them where they are on the map. And it's done as a team sport. Everyone debates and moves things around until you come to agreement.
So wait, so the product has a certain place, right? Like a, and then individuals as well, they could be placed on this.
Individuals fall onto the map, and so do brands.
Okay, so brands make sense. Products make sense. Tell me about people. Like how do people fall on the map?
Well, it depends. Again, it's very specific as to what the objective is. But let's say I'm developing a new cell phone.
Okay.
And for example, I look at the market for cell phones and the applications, and I would say, based on personas, people are going upper right, with that cell phone, right? We're looking for, you have your phone, you're in a restaurant, if it looks antiquated, how do you feel about yourself? If you it looks fresh, new, like you're current, you're connected, that's kind of taking you upper right. Right. Now we
Got
change
it,
this.
got it. So
So that
for a lot
changes.
of like high innovation, high kind of commitment type of products, it's
That's
upper
right.
right. But if you're like, I'm okay with my like 20-year-old flip phone, and I'm like getting away from phones as much as possible. Like, so that doesn't really matter to me.
Yeah, you may be lower left. You may be more in the basic quadrant.
And then somebody else may be like, it's a BlackBerry. Just use it to send an email and not to like express myself in a meaningful way. Yeah. So, okay, that makes a lot. So then you're kind of these personalities, and then you can pick and choose who's your ideal buyer profile then based on
what
you're building, right?
Yeah, but it goes beyond that. It goes into predictive modeling. So as you learn the personas, you find out where they are today. So let's call that voice of consumer. It's where are they today? But basically what you learn is that, but where do they want to go?
Mm.
Right? We have to motivate someone, hopefully, to do something beneficial for themselves they otherwise wouldn't do. So people want to evolve. People want to grow. They want to be more tomorrow than they are today. That's kind of the human nature. And so you take a look and you say, people want to go upright. In many cases today, they want to go upper left. They're saying, I want low interactivity and high self-actualization. You know, I want to just talk to my phone. I don't want to even touch the button. I want to
it's
turn
too complex.
It off.
I don't want to think about it. It's like, interesting, right?
I want this beautiful artifact that is completely voice activated. And the minute I touch it, it comes on. You know, it's like, what would you like to do today? You know, call my wife, right? That's where a lot of people are going. So you have to project, say, okay, but where do people want to go today? And that's where we need to land. Otherwise, all you're going to do is end up behind the times. So it became a predictive model that we were able to say, okay, here's how we forecast the future of where people want to land. And as you do this, you find out things like we were doing DNA sequencers. We thought they would be all in the high utilization, the technology quadrant, lower right. As we spoke to the scientists and chief medical officers and everyone, the other thing about DNA sequencing is this is going to change the planet. It's going to increase the quality of life for everyone on the planet. And we're looking for a signature design that says this is the future of medical science. They weren't about
and
like
the moment you say signature, that means like it's top. Typically, it's like something very
extra. They're going to
upper right corner, right?
Upper right quadrant.
Yeah,
and
got it. Okay.
Not all the way up, but definitely further than where everything else was. And when we created
and that's
that,
a B2B, quote unquote, B2B product.
That's a B. That's strictly a B2B.
So basically, what you're saying is, so this is B2B product or scientific product. And it's not about science necessarily. It's also about the perception of where this type of science fits in into the persona of the buyer.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Personal identity. The personal identity that's created through that design language. And that was a phenomenal success. You know, that company, and not just because of the global design language we did for Life Technologies, but because they came out with new technology, allowed you to do a sequence in 2 hours for $1,000. That took them from a $5 billion market cap to an exit 4 months after the launch of the new product to an exit of $15 billion.
So when we think, when you've developed and tested and refined this framework, and it feels like it's very sophisticated because you're going to kind of find out where the customer is moving or wants to move to, where they are and where they want to move towards. You'll kind of see what product you're dealing with and like, does it fit that? And you're going to try and potentially be constrained a little bit by what the product can do. And then there's the brand. Sounds like some brands have certain permissions, and in other cases, you may need to create a whole new brand or not even try something because you wouldn't leverage the brand distribution advantage. So how do you mix all of that?
Could be the presentation of the brand. Yeah. So when we talk about where people want to go, that creates the white space. And if you're looking at the competitive landscape, You have to say, okay, you know, is that white space? You know, is that blue ocean? You know,
right.
And if
So
it
you
is,
start with that. You start with where do people generally want to go?
Exactly.
You don't want to start with like, I built this tech and it's really cool and it does this in 2 hours, what used to be 20 hours. No, you got to, yes, that's going to inform you later, but you got to start with the way,
that's
where
right.
do people want to go? And then the competitive density around that.
That's right.
Okay.
And then you test the different brands, including
yes.
that brand. It could be in the case of Life Technologies, they're branding on all of their products, and they had grown through acquisition. So it was over 30 different companies had come together, you know, all as individual profit centers and running as individual. You know, their badge said Life Technologies, a division, boom, boom, boom. You know, and what we did is we just took all that and made it into a clean little badge that said Life Technologies. And we took all the verbiage out because they were lower right on their branding, and we moved them right into that opportunity zone. And what we did was we floated the words life, the word life, in between two pieces of clear plastic. And then we put technologies on the back of the plastic and put white on the back. And what it did is it made a true drop shadow so that as you walked by, it had a little bit of life to it based on the lighting, right? So it wasn't like a, you know, like a printed drop shadow. It was a real, real drop shadow. And DNA kind of floats in space. And so it had like a different resonance. So that's how you move the brands, you know, into that zone. But we also
so
use
you
it
start
for,
experiencing almost the promise of that product the moment you look at, like, you're getting that great first impression, and sort of like when we were talking about Apple, like you get the feeling of the Apple the moment you start opening the package. And so you were doing that for B2B.
And that ties into the hero's journey. So we've built personas, we've taken user journeys, we've looked at pain states, transformed into help me statements. But then ultimately, we take people through the hero's journey. So we leveraged Maslow, then we leveraged Campbell, and we said, okay, Campbell found the universal truth that in all culture throughout time, that the story of the heroes emerged in all great religions and storytelling. And what we said was that let's use the hero's journey as the narrative of the story of a product or a service or anything experience, because we want to make people feel like a hero every day of their life. So what we did is then we, with all of that said, then we take it, and when we get to design, we say, how do we use design to attract someone? The call to action.
Okay.
How do we engage them through micro affirmations, which is you know, the challenge. And once you're attracted to something, you're always a little bit hesitant. It's like, yeah, but are you going to disappoint me? You know, it's like, you know, pretty looking can opener. But you know, are you just gonna disappoint me? You know, there's a famous there's a very famous juicer for oranges and lemons made by Philippe Starck with three legs, beautiful, you know, acorn, but you can't use it. It's just beautiful, and people have it. I mean, they have it in their kitchen because it's such a work of art. But you know, you go through these tests and you say, okay, you know, you start getting affirmation after affirmation, and then eventually you adopt it. When
so
you
let,
adopt
let's
it,
so 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 on the so maybe like take a step back. So let's connect what you were just describing to Hero's Journey. Like, so like, let's illustrate, how does Hero's Journey work in the either product design or maybe your first onboarding design? A lot of our customers are, you know, creating content, and I think that it oftentimes it's almost super important to communicate the journey all the challenges and like desperation even before you encounter the product, to kind of get them like, have you tried this, but you're persistent because you want it. But then tell us, like, how do you create that, you know, Joseph Campbell meets modern design experience?
Well, you've got to have incredible levels of design talent. Okay. Because people are experts in design. Mm-hmm. You know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, you know, design was more of an elite type of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, today we're in a village in Africa talking to, you know, a teenager, mm-hmm. telling us about, you know, Nike, and telling us about Apple, and telling, you know, all the coolest stuff. And they can, you know, they can write an essay on design. So we've learned maybe through Apple and others that
design quotient is
response.
So design quotient is gone through the roof in the last.
Oh, absolutely.
And this visual or everything, like, is like, I mean, I guess most of it, like, where you're mostly in the visual universe, but let's say even copy or content as well.
Yeah. It's true in everything. It's true in copy, having the right headline, having the right, you know, attractor that attracts someone right away. You call it the hook in marketing, right?
So basically, there's a lot less room for error for the modern consumer, be they third world or, you know, enterprise B2B. Doesn't matter. They are all savvy design, savvy design consumers in their everyday life.
Yeah. Okay. And even in an MVP, like PAAI will launch next month with an MVP. You gotta check the boxes, because, you know, people have, you know, Deepak Chopra calls it a yum and yuck response. You know, you will look at something and immediately say, fits me, you know, I relate to it, I'm attracted to it, I want to engage with it, or, you know, yeah, not for me.
We have a saying for content, like for our customers, like, you never get a obviously second chance to make first impression. When it comes to, like, and so that kind of is like, No, people judge your ebook by your cover, or they judge your annual report by your cover, right? We kind of like to think that, oh, I worked so hard on getting it all right and all compliant and all, like, checked all the dots. And then it looks like everything else. And I'll read it if I have to, but I'm not going to be, but it's my impression is like, it's everything else. And yeah, that's probably defeats the purpose of all that work, right?
So that's the call to action. That's a call to action. And you're
making it a call to adventure almost, right? Because, like, I think the way you've set up the, like if we think of Campbell, it's more than just like attracting it, right? It's sort of,
oh no, it's engagement.
More. It's right.
It's engagement, it's adoption, it's the moment of truth. Mm. First time you use something or share something, it should make you feel good about yourself, because it's about self-actualization. You know, we're all looking for self-affirmation and self-actualization. Mm. You know, I'm looking for it from you, and you're looking for it from me. And we're on a hero's journey together right now. That, you know, something attracted us to this call. We're engaging. We're now testing ideas, right? And eventually, hopefully, you'll adopt some of my ideas and share them. And that's the moment of truth. And when that happens, then the hero emerges, and your body language changes, your self-esteem changes, you start sharing. And the best example I have is the most mundane product we've ever done is a can opener for the global brand Zylus, or Zylus, as it's called. You've probably seen Zylus products all over kitchens everywhere. And as we were designing their new generation can opener, we're going through the psychoesthetics, we're going through the user journeys, we're going through all of this, and we said, This has actually got a very difficult experience. There's hundreds of canopers out there. You have to squeeze the two handles together and turn a lever, and if you get distracted and you release your hand a little bit, you got a void and you got to do it all over again. You got to really focus. And we said, let's make the two handles click together. So when you puncture the can, the handles are holding together, and you just turn the knob, and now it becomes, completely mindless. That's got over almost 40,000 reviews on Amazon
That feature alone.
for a can opener,
Yeah.
right? And so part of it is that if you're looking over the horizon, you say, how can I create a viral effect
Right.
through self-actualization that's so powerful that people will write about their can opener, that they want to share their can opener experience, $15 can opener. And I don't write Amazon reviews, but I mean, how do you create a phenomenon when, can openers go back to the time of Napoleon, I think, and there's hundreds of choices, and it's not about beauty, but use beauty to attract and then add the interaction.
So it's beauty plus utility plus like you make the well it kind of is that an interaction? There is an interaction because there is a click there your it's your experience.
There's a click and there's the haptic of how you feel it click, and there's a little sound.
That's beautiful. So you know what, like else this is for our audience for Relate to AI. When you were describing your two by two and I was just thinking like so you're taking this sort of low interactive, low actualization report that you're sh sharing. It's almost like black and white can opener, like kind of thing, right? Like, and you're tur you imagine you're turning it into, multi-dimensional, multimodal, highly interactive, highly aesthetic, version. And you're like, let's forget how you do it, but and so you can literally. In that case, you get to the areas that you want to in the report. You don't have to go page by page, right? You interact. If you are a video person, you get a video. If you're an audio person, you could listen to like mini podcast snippets on the areas of interest. If you're AI super user, right, you could chat with AI, right? But you don't know who you are necessarily. So, this report could adapt to your needs, and so it becomes a much deeper personal experience. And on that front page, there's a video that plays automatically that signals that this is not your grandma's report built in the basement somewhere, 30 years ago. And so that I think beautifully fits into your framework because you're basically creating extra layers of interactivity and ownership for the viewer, and then there's self-actualization. Then I could say like, "Hey, I want to control what I read. I don't want to be controlled by you." That's kind of feels like that's self-actualization. I want to, I want to control my time. I want to like, and I want to control how I like learn, And so I want to be empowered.
That's right. That's right.
And
Empowerment is the right.
right. And if I want to drill in, I don't want to be like, I want to drill in, right? Like I might want to actually spend. Like you make it very easy for me to not read your report and just get to one snippet that I need to. But on that one snippet, I might actually spend a lot more time and then I'm intrigued. I'll go back and read more. So we're seeing like evidence now through engagement data. So in a way, like what you're, I'm glad we dug into it because I think we've been secretly stealing your framework and how we're thinking about it. Does that resonate with you, like from a digital content perspective,
Oh, absolutely.
going?
And it resonates from a PAAI position also, that where are LLMs today and where does PAAI take it? So if you're,
But tell us more about PAAI. I know this is super exciting for you to bring to life your methodology in the new form factor.
yeah, it's like any great tool. And it happens rarely, but it's like new technology comes along, and we've got this proven tool we've used for 3.5 decades as a tool, And we've used it for companies like Lego and Intel and Samsung. And I mean, the list goes on and on.
This is the your framework, your the
this is the
psychoesthetic.
Psychoesthetics.
Yeah.
And then and Harvard did a case study on it. And Harvard then did a classroom exercise. And then I co-authored a book with Deepa Prahlad, under the guidance of C.K. Prahlad, called Predictable Magic. That was with Wharton Publishing. And I published two additional books on it. So, you know, here's a solid methodology, and along comes technology that all of a sudden says, wait a minute, we can turn what we've done into digital signal that can then be applied to AI and can take the human side of interaction and plug that into AI, so that you can't make AI think like a human. AI can't predict the future, right? It can't predict emotion.
But you know how human, but you know human factors.
Yes. So we take all of that, but we also ingest. We have an incredible ingestion engine. We ingest pretty much everything about that we can throw into the hopper, and then it builds a psychoesthetics model that basically has all psychoesthetics. And then we go through another seven modules, go through, you know, what is the opportunity definition? How do you capture that opportunity, go to market? How do you finance it? How do you build an organization around it? How do you market it? What's your go to market? And so we basically took all of our experience in incubating companies and layered that on top of psychoesthetics, and said, based on psychoesthetics, we could have interactivity between all these modules that cross-feed each other. Mm-hmm. And now you have output that is McKinsey quality, right? 300-page decks that show the pathway to high EV, what the risks are to avoid, what's the pathway. And now what we hope is that instead of having 70 to 80% new initiatives failing, that we now have, 50%, 60% success rate, and people can now do things more efficiently and more successfully through that. But as we've run it, and we talked about your hero's journey. So one of my key team members, who's been with me 35 years, so he's been running it. And this is how we've been developing all of the software for it, and he runs it on a private chat, proprietary private chat. It's addictive. I mean, I will see him, I mean, it is so empowering, so self-actualizing. You get an email, at 1 a.m. You don't want to go home because it's showing you things that you just never even realize. You said, we would have had to develop this new app, this new software, this new product. And we would have had to go all the way down this pathway to find out that we have a missing link, that we have, that there's something in there that's going to cause rejection. Because people aren't going to understand it, people aren't going to adopt it, people aren't going to see the value in it. All of that is exposed, very early on, and it's defined as to what to do, who to do it for, what's the pathway, what's the experience, what's the value, all the way down to enterprise value.
If I had to pick up on this, you're infusing design was this methodology and a data-driven approach, so that you can de-risk innovation for companies,
yeah.
Right? Like fundamentally, a lot of the problems was this thing: you try five things, and half of them works. Point zero out of five works, and you have to try 10 things, right? And what you're saying is, you have a much higher predictability of success.
Yeah. So it's risk mitigation. The other benefit is, or there's probably a few other benefits, is that it forms team alignment.
Hmm.
So, you know, one of the biggest challenges for large organizations, especially in the global scheme, is team alignment and team drift. And so that through the visual assets, through sharing with everyone, you can keep your team together, you can keep them on track, you can have shared mission and vision and a shared pathway to get there.
And these
And
are, yeah, go ahead, you sorry.
that's a byproduct, but it's a huge byproduct.
Well, especially because of the size and names of your clients, right? Like if you're working on a major launch, you have a global multi-stakeholder team, right? From let's say supply chain, manufacturing, design, marketing, et cetera, right? And so what you're saying is you're able to bring them all together
Oh, yeah.
in one place. How does this work in the earlier stage environment? I'm sure there's, you were launching a lot of products rapidly, but like then there's not as much time to do research. But how would you think about this?
Yeah, we get entrepreneurs, or more recent entrepreneur came in, and we've been on the project, let's say 4 months, and now they're at a point of kind of go or no go, and we did a comprehensive 250-page PAAI, analysis and strategy. And we did all the financial modeling, everything. We figured out, exactly the pathway to take a $4 million investment and generate an EV of 800 million in 5 years without them having to like enter the market. And in that case, what we did was that the original concept was to create a direct-to-consumer product. And as we developed the technology and used psychosthetics to actually develop the technology and target the user experience in a way, what we found was the direct pathway is a split between B2B to C and to use international distributors for the global play. And that took it from a high-risk position to, boom, here's exactly the pathway. Here's exactly how you're going to go to market. Here's exactly how much you need to invest in everything to get to market and what your ROI is and the profitability of it. And so the other way you can use it if you're idea generating is you float your idea. Even with minimal input, you float your idea through PAAI, and it'll show you the SPS score, the success potential score. It'll show you that, and it'll show you what you should or shouldn't do. And then you can start to toggle and say, well, what if I did this? What if I did that? Or here's another idea.
Right.
And that works for services and for product.
Got it. So that actually probably leads me to kind of the question that I'd like to wrap us up on, that I think you're probably answering that your software could answer it. But like, what do you see as the biggest mistakes that companies consistently make as they, work without you, or maybe even at the beginning of the journeys of working with you, w that you could help them avoid? Is there a pattern that you've seen?
It's the same. It is this the same difficult answer. Is that how that how do you avoid misalignment with the people who are going to make decisions about whether they adopt your new brand, service, product, anything? When I would teach, I would talk about, you could create the an advancement in a scalpel. You could say this is a better scalpel, but you have to understand that it's impossible for a surgeon to switch because they're programmed, right, to make a precise cut that can't even be measured with that tool that they've learned on. And so, so somebody comes to us and says, we've got this great technology and we're going to do an electronic scalpel, yada, yada, yada. say, oh, great technology, yeah, and it can improve the quality of life and make less mistakes and all that. But there's a misalignment with the end surgeon who can't learn a new device because it's so programmed. I mean, this is one example, but we have examples like that every day in our life where it's like, yeah, that's not for me. Right. And that happens in all kinds of categories. It happens every day in our lives, right? It's kind of like yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And our emotions do a lot of that filtering for us. So you can't forget the emotional content of, you know, that self-actualization, that empowerment, that, you know, that fear of making a bad decision, or in the case of business, you know, huge, huge failure rates.
And is that okay? If as long as you, I guess you don't need to please everybody, right? Like you could, your product could be right for certain things. But what I hear you saying is a lot of people make the wrong assumption that they will please that audience, and then there's a, or that they are right for that audience, and then there's a misalignment. So it's not that it's sort of for your chosen audience, there needs to be the sort of all the stars need to align.
That's correct. And you don't need to move everything to the upper right or upper left.
Right.
You know, I mean, that may be impossible, you know, to do. You need to find a path and a roadmap to start migrating to where people want to go. And as you connect, then you get brand resonance, you get value in the company, you get profitability. I've said a lot in a little time, a bit.
Robbie, last question as we wrap up. How do people learn more about all your products and you, and you know, bring more beautiful design into their life?
Well, there's Psychoesthetics 2.0 is on Amazon.
Okay.
And that's a great book. PA-AI is a website now, and there's a list that you can join for announcements and such. RKSdesign.com has case studies one after another. Every project that RKS Design shows, it shows how did we do it? How did we get there? So our philosophy is always like share the process so that everyone benefits. You know, it's not something we're just going to hold to ourselves. We want the world to be a better place. We want, you know, design, innovation, entrepreneurship, all to succeed. I mean, you know, hopefully more success means a better world for everyone.
Beautiful. Let's design a beautiful world. Ravi, Sani, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Alex. Pleasure.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relateto.com, RELYTO.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relateto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.